Lecture 22. New Standards in English.
Samuel Johnson's dictionary had an immense impact on the teaching, study, and scholarship of the English language in the decades after its publication. 1755, the original publication of the dictionary, and in its many subsequent editions throughout the 18th and the 19th century, Samuel Johnson's dictionary quite simply became the dictionary of the English language. But as I suggested in my previous lecture, Johnson's dictionary participates in a larger set of debates about the nature of language study and teaching. And what I'd like to do in this lecture is focus on a couple of contemporaries of Samuel Johnson to illustrate one of the central tensions at the time and to link that tension to a larger arc in the theme of this course as a whole. That theme is the relationship between prescriptivism and descriptivism. Should the study of language prescribe behavior? Should we study language in order to instruct us in what we should say? Or should the study of language be largely descriptive? Should our goal be simply to describe forms of behavior that are out there? The paradox of description, however, is the paradox of recognizing that whenever you describe something, depending on your authority or your position or your rhetorical control, you will almost invariably prescribe something. If you are of enough power or authority, or if you put it in a memorable way, your description becomes a prescription. And so even though Johnson recognized in the preface to his dictionary that it was impossible to form or fix or register a language, nonetheless, the immense authority and brilliance of the dictionary itself made it an arbiter of linguistic usage for over a century after its publication. Two figures of the 18th century who exemplify the debate on prescriptivism versus descriptivism are Robert Loth and Joseph Priestley. Now, Loth and Priestley were both engaged not only in the linguistic discussions of their time, but on the social and religious debates of the last half of the 18th century. And so they may exemplify some aspects of English intellectual culture as well as English linguistic and literary study. Robert Loth was Bishop of London. He was educated at Oxford, and he was a key figure in the religious and the educational establishment in England in the second half of the 18th century. He was the author of many works on language, including his Principles of English Grammar, which first appeared in 1762 and which was revised in 1787. Loth was clearly a prescriptivist. In his Principles, he remarked that his goal was, quote, to teach what is right by teaching what is right and wrong. And so grammar, he believed, was a system of rules. And in his work called A Short Introduction to English Grammar, Loth defined grammar itself as, quote, the art of rightly expressing our thoughts in words. He believed, in fact, that English grammar was the best of all. Of all the European languages, he said, quote, English is much the most simple in its form and construction. And Loth held that whatever difficulties may exist in communication were the fault of what he called practice and not of the language itself. And he blamed people's lack of what he called propriety and accuracy. To teach what is right by showing what is both right and wrong. So what makes Loth a prescriptivist is this notion of the axes of right and wrong. Grammar, for Loth, is not a universal category of making or marking relationships among syntax or meaning, nor Is it a habit of mind? It is an art of right expression. And common principles are applied to a particular language according to accepted forms of usage and custom. One cannot but look back on Loth from our perspective and see in his establishment qualities, in his place in the English establishment, a sense of the desire to establish grammatical categories and rules. Even though Loth holds that English grammar was, as he says, much the most simple, nonetheless, as a figure of the ecclesiastical and political establishment, he wants to use Latin as a template for that grammar. And so one of the things he does in great detail in many of his grammatical and pedagogical works is he tries to make, if you like, the paradigms of English nouns and verbs correspond to the paradigms of Latin nouns and verbs. So you have cases, or you have declensions, or you have conjugations that are organized on Latin models. Now, I want to contrast Loth with Joseph Priestley. Joseph Priestley was not an Englishman, but he was a Scot. He was an empiricist. He was a scientist. He was, in fact, one of the discoverers of the element oxygen. He was the founder of Unitarianism. Now, as an experimental scientist and as an empiricist, he was a follower of his fellow Scotsman David Hume, and he was very interested in deducing general principles from observation. He said things like, language, like water, will seek its own natural level. And among the things he wrote on language were what he called the rudiments of English grammar, which was first published in 1761, revised in 1772, and published frequently thereafter. Priestley considered grammar not as an essential quality of language, but as what he called, quote, a collection of observations on the structure of it and a system of rules for the proper use of it. And this is a very important distinction from Loth's, that the idea here is that grammar is a collection of observations on the structure of language rather than an art of rightly expressing thoughts and words. That Priestley's concern is, if you like, looking at the world out there and deducing general principles from it. And so he applies his empiricist scientific methodology to the study of language itself. Part of this, of course, is not without its value judgments. And one of the key features of British empiricism of the 18th century, and a good deal of the experimental science that emerged from it, was a belief in simplicity. That is, that nature, at its most natural, was simple, and that the laws of nature, or that the equations that govern those laws, were to be reduced to their most simple form. As an aside, it seems to me one of the still controlling aesthetic principles of science, the idea that there's something aesthetically beautiful in the simple equation, and that nature's laws, if we could only understand them, would be revealed as truly simple. And so what Priestley favored was the elimination of those aspects of the English language that he thought made it not simple. He favored the elimination of what he called Gallicisms from language, that is, forms of French, big words. He was interested in finding what he called the true idiom of the English language and what he called the genius of the language. And I think it's important to recognize that even though these are loaded terms, and even though these would make us believe that what Priestley is talking about is something like, you know, the English language is somehow better than all others, or the sense that there is a purer English than any other, what we need to understand is that he's really talking about the English language in the way he's talking about nature. And that is, he wants to get to the heart of it. He wants to find the true genius, by which he means not genius in the modern sense of brilliant people. He wants to find the origin. He wants to find what makes English most characteristically English in the way that one looks for what is most characteristic in, let's say, a species or in a chemical reaction. And so he considered the study of language as a system of empirical observation, but as someone who was intimately involved in the religious and political controversies of his day, he offers a political edge to language study. And here is a quotation that I have gotten from the 1772 edition of The Rudiments of English Grammar. And I want to read it to you because I think it is a profoundly resonant statement for the history of language. And he writes, "I think it not only unsuitable to the genius of a free nation, but in itself ill-calculated to reform and fix a language." Look at this language, the genius of a free nation. Priestley, who would eventually travel to America and bring Unitarianism to America, Priestley is working in a world in which discussions of language are always political, and where the notion of nation is central to the understanding of language itself. And so in 1772, a phrase like the genius of a free nation must resonate with the incipient debates on the status of the American colonies, with the relationship between kingship and common profit, and with notions of ill calculation to reform and fix a language. Reform now as a matter of social and political reform, calculation now not simply as a matter of toting up the numbers on the board of life, but of reckoning up the taxation and representation that would be so much a key feature of the American Rebellion of the 1770s. And so I want to stress here, the end of the 18th century, the profound political resonances of debates on prescriptivism and descriptivism at the very moment of American Rebellion. One of the key issues also that emerges from this debate is not simply the matter of grammatical correctness, what is right and what is wrong, and also not only the issue of political control, but matters of social behavior. In other words, what is proper and what is improper. And the word propriety comes to develop at the end of the 18th century as one of the touchstone words for linguistic and social behavior. And I would like to spend some time looking now at propriety. Propriety is a remarkable word, and we can use the resources of 18th century lexicography and linguistic criticism to understand its remarkable qualities. The word propriety comes, of course, from the same Latin root as the word proper, and both of them go back to an idea of belonging to, something that is one's own, something that is, in fact, a matter of propriety. And the term developed from words for physical or commercial use, and then it became one of linguistic use, and then it became one of social action. And I've talked about this process in earlier lectures as extension in lexis. That is, the way in which a word moves from a highly technical and specific definition to a set of larger, more figurative and social definitions. When you look up the word propriety in Johnson's dictionary in the first edition of 1755, what you get is the following definition. First, peculiarity of possession, exclusive right. So you're not getting a social definition here. Propriety is not how you behave well in a particular situation. Propriety is about owning something, exclusive right. Definition two is accuracy, justness, especially in a linguistic sense. And here, Johnson offers a quotation from one of his most favorite arbiters of language and philosophy, the late 17th and early 18th century philosopher John Locke. And here is the quotation from Locke that Johnson uses to illustrate his definition, too, of propriety. Quote, "Common sense, that is the rule of propriety, affords some aid to settle the signification of language." So what propriety means here is a grammatical rather than a social issue. It can mean accuracy of expression, but what it also means is the use of proper grammatical forms or endings. In other words, that when 18th century writers write about propriety in language, what they're talking about, for example, is concord between a noun and a verb. That is, making sure that if you have a plural noun, you use a plural verb. Or making sure that there are certain case relationships. Or making sure that you use the right preposition in a particular phrase. Only by extension does the word propriety take on stylistic and social connotation. So what we're looking at the close of the 18th century is a very important cultural shift. What is grammatically proper becomes socially acceptable. Now, in Loth's book, The Principles of English Grammar, he uses the phrase propriety in the following way, quote, "The rule of propriety, as he says, means grammatical concord in, quote, making the signification of language meaningful." And he's using this in a very special sense. Loth was very interested, as I mentioned earlier, in finding ways of describing English grammar in terms of Latin grammar. And Loth was very concerned in a very technical discussion with making sure that English could have a subjunctive mood. And I've talked about the subjunctive. That is, the counterfactual, or the conditional, or the optative. That is, a way of expressing something that isn't there, that you'd like to be there, that might be there. Were I doing something? That's the subjunctive. And Loth's discussion is highly technical, but the point I want to draw from that technical discussion, without going into all of the details of his 18th century pedantry, is the simple fact that the issue of propriety for Loth is an issue of grammar. It is not an issue of social decorum. Gradually, over time, these grammatical issues become social issues. When Johnson writes in the preface to the dictionary in 1755 that the illiterate, quote, forget propriety in their speech and writing, what he means is that they write awkwardly or ungrammatically. It does not mean that they are speaking badly in terms of subject matter. The issue is not a subject matter issue. The issue is a grammar issue. By 1784, Fanny Burney, novelist, social critic, one of the great arbiters of late 18th century taste, could write, quote, "Such propriety of mind as can only result from the union of good sense and virtue." This is very important because now good sense and virtue are matters of propriety. And it seems to me that what's at stake here in Fanny Burney is precisely the idea of grammatical concord, of technical grammatical performance as the mark of social accomplishment. Virtue, that word virtue again, is the moral basis of social behavior. Recall the way in which virtue appeared in the Canterbury Tales, of which vertu engendered is the fleur. In Middle English and in early modern English, just as in Latin, virtue is a distinctively masculine category. It has to do with power, and it has to do with the power to engender, quite simply. By the 18th century, virtue is not an inner quality of the man, but an outer quality of the social being. And indeed, virtue comes by the 18th century, by the middle of the 18th century, to be associated with female forms of performance. Indeed, chastity, that Richardson's Pamela, can be subtitled virtue rewarded. And so in late 18th century literature, propriety became the marker of exactly this nexus of the social and the moral in behavior. Lawrence Stern's great novella, Sentimental Journey of 1762, uses the term propriety precisely in its modern social sense, but he uses it as if it were a loan word from French. He spells it propriété. It is italicized. It is something which, as a concept word, he wants to signal is not fully part of English. If you like, one could write a history of the English novel, and one could certainly make an argument for someone like Jane Austen as a novelist of propriety, precisely in this late 18th century sense. That is, the way in which verbal performance becomes the marker of social accomplishment, and that verbal performance and grammatical ability generates what Fanny Burney called the union of good sense and virtue. Now, along with this debate on propriety is a larger debate on slang and colloquialism. And I mentioned in my previous lecture the way in which Johnson, in his dictionary, beginning in its first edition of 1755, signals certain words as improper, by which I'm now meaning improper in its modern sense. Johnson arbitrates certain kinds of words, and I mentioned how low words for Johnson are not simply words that come from the vulgar or words of a particular subject matter. They're words that are socially unacceptable because they sound funny or they have a certain aesthetic cacophony to them. And I mentioned swap, twiddle twaddle, wobble, budge, and also words like coax and touchy, monosyllabic, reduplicating, onomatopoetic terms. I mentioned also chaperone, which he describes as an affected word of very recent introduction. And what we see in this definition is really the origin of our modern sense of affectation. That is, the way in which one can affect behavior. That is, the way in which one acts or speaks in a manner that is unnatural, in a manner that is un-English, and is a manner that, for so much of British and American narrative, is quite simply a manner that is French. Now, the legacy of examples such as these can be found in our own dictionaries, and I would like to conclude this lecture by looking ahead, by bridging to my next two lectures, and by in effect saying, when we read a dictionary today, what we are very often looking at is the legacy of these 18th century lexicographers, teachers, pedagogues, and pedants, the way in which the arbitration of linguistic use can be found in the details of a definition. Now, we can see this in some obvious places. We can see this in a word like ain't. Now, I've always been taught, as I'm sure many of you have been taught, that the word ain't is inappropriate. And yet, ain't was a word of affectation in the novels of Dorothy Sayers when she has Lord Peter Wimsey talk as in this way and say ain't. Peter Wimsey will also drop his G's in the participles, goin' instead of going. And one of the questions that a discussion like this raises is a question of whether or not we're looking at a kind of affectation of the common. What is the relationship between upper and lower, what later became to be called you and non-you speech? But there are more complicated ways of looking at this, and perhaps the most fascinating lies in the Oxford English Dictionary. Now, you'll remember Johnson on chaperone, an affected word of very recent introduction. He doesn't like it because it's French. If you go to the Oxford English Dictionary, what you're looking at are strata of work definitions that were originally written in the 1880s and 1890s, collocations of quotations that were drawn at the beginning of the 20th century. The Oxford English Dictionary was published from the early 1880s until the late 1920s. It was put together in complete form in 1933, and there have been subsequent supplements. Indeed, the third edition is now online. And yet, in definitions and descriptions, you can see the legacy of judgment. One of my favorite words to look up in the OED is the word protocol. Because here, again, you have a word that is part of the vocabulary of social performance. One follows protocol. One follows protocol diplomatically. One follows protocol also scientifically. But if you look up the word protocol in the Oxford English Dictionary, you get this remarkable quotation, which I would like to read for you. "The history of the sense development of this word belongs to medieval Latin and the Romance languages, especially French. In the latter, it has received very considerable extensions of meaning." And then the OED lists a set of famous lexicographers. And then it says, "The word does not appear to have at any time formed part of the English legal vocabulary. It is," the OED says, "in Scottish from the 16th century, probably under French influence. Otherwise used only in reference to foreign countries and their institutions, and as a recognized form of international diplomacy until its comparatively recent entry into the general vocabulary of English." Now, this is still the language of Johnson. How do you define a word as English? How do you mark it as something not English? And clearly here, what the OED wants to say is that the word protocol is really French. The word does not appear to have at any time formed part of the English legal vocabulary. And it goes on in long definition after definition and use after use. It talks about, and here's another part of it, "the formulary of the etiquette to be observed by the head of state in official ceremonies in France, relations with ambassadors and the like." And so the quotations that the OED gives are designed to show you something of the alien or un-English quality of protocol. And the reason why I am calling this to your attention is to show you that even in a modern dictionary, we are saddled with the legacy of 18th century linguistic judgments. Let me conclude with one other word from the OED that gives us, again, a narrative of social use and grammatical propriety. And this is the word quiz. There will be no quiz after this lecture. But if you look up quiz in the OED, what you get is of obscure origin, possibly a fanciful coinage, but it is doubtful whether any reliance can be placed on the anecdote of its invention by Daly, a Dublin theater manager. Now, once again, you have this magnificent moment of linguistic exile, if you like. For if protocol should not be admitted into English because it is ultimately a word of French, quiz hovers on the very margins of the language because it is a word A, from Ireland, Daly, a Dublin theater manager, and B, a word of the theater. Now, the original editors of the Oxford English Dictionary at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th centuries could, in many of their definitions, think of nothing so bad to say about a word as that it was theatrical, that it came from the theater, and that in future lectures I will show you, in some other words, the ways in which the OED eliminates or judges or hierarchizes words according to their naturalness or their theatricality. Quiz and protocol represent the kinds of words that have entered everyday speech in almost transparent ways. But when we look at their history and lexicography, what we're looking at are the legacies of prescriptivism and descriptivism, and the recognition that even our most modern dictionaries today still bear the imprint of the 18th century lexicographers who would chart low words and seek to use linguistic categories to regulate social propriety.